الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، شفيع ذنوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وحبيب قلوبنا بالقاسم محمد. وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين، ولعنة الله الدائمة على أعدائهم أجمعين. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. أما بعد، السلام عليكم جميعا ورحمة الله وبركاته. أعظم الله أجورنا وأجوركم بمصابنا بأبي عبد الله الحسين عليه الصلاة والسلام. The coming of the Prophet, and we wonder why Allah would send 11 Imams, one after another, in such a short span of time, and indefinitely postpone the coming of the 12th. It is a question we ask ourselves. The Blessed Prophet wrote the Quran. He found a society immersed in traditions that were curtailing the progress of their humanity. Cultures that had become a curse upon the people. What happens at times is that since we follow these practices and cultures, we cannot look beyond them to see an alternative. And since religiously, or sort of, we bind ourselves to follow these cultures, these very practices become a curse, self-imposed curse upon us, that we have to do this. The society in its time was imbalanced. The people buried their daughters, not wanting to, but pressurized by the culture that they themselves. Of course, there's a history behind the burying of the daughters. But you see how cultures prevail, man-made cultures, and how they suffocate the people that follow them. There was an unjust social-economical system. The system of the gods Lat and Al-Uzza, these were not mere statues. These were a representation of the ideology of those who exploited others to keep the power base, to allow them to do whatever they wanted. All forms of evils were prevalent. Salawat. Some orators, they command respect, don't they? By the brilliance of what they say. But people like me demand it. So pay attention. You didn't get that. No. By force I demand attention, so that's what I mean to say. When the Prophet came, he came to a society which was extremely unjust, imbalanced. He brought about a revolution. He appealed to the masses. You know the fundamental reason why revolutions occur. Because of injustice, social, economical, or political, whatever injustice. And revolution occurs primarily by the hands or upon the hands of those who are dealt with unjustly or are oppressed, to redress the balance. What the Prophet did was, he awakened the masses to the social evils and the false cultures and appealed to them. He stood in front of the Kaaba and he recited the Quran. The people who would go for the pilgrimage were told that this Muhammad is a sorcerer. Allahu salla ala Muhammad. Do not listen to his words, he shall bewitch you. You see, intellect, he appealed to the minds of the people and the hearts of the people. This is how he created free man. There was a person who went for the pilgrimage. He had put cotton wool in his ears so that he may not listen to the words of this man known as the prophet, or who called himself to be the prophet. Curiosity got the better of him. He saw a handsome man addressing a small crowd. He extracted the cotton from his ears and he heard the prophet saying or reciting the verses of Surah Al-Hud. O people, do not deceive each other when you transact with each other. As you like to take proper measures, give back proper measures. This man automatically realized that the prophet is addressing a social evil. This is the very thing that has become the curse and the cause of so much grief in our society. Unfair trade. And then the prophet went on to say, and do not bury your children, do not kill your children through the fear of poverty. We sustain them and we sustain you. And immediately he realized that this burying of the daughters, killing of children, was the worst form of evil that they were performing, and they could not find any means of release. It appealed to him, to his mind, to his conscience, and he followed. Now the Prophet brought about this revolution. What is the immediate need of the people when a revolution comes about? When you go to an oppressed people and you guarantee them that their stomachs will be satiated and they will have roof over their heads, the destitute will revolt, because that is the primary need. Think about this. The Prophet brought a grand message, but the primary impulse there was of that basic physical need, that people should get their stomachs filled with food. They should get shelter over their heads. That was their primary concern from this revolution. People could not think beyond it at that moment. When we go to preach Islam, tell me, when we give Quran, when we give Sahifa Sajjadiyah and Nahjul Balagha, will the people eat it? Will they put it over their heads? When people are hungry, when they are dying of hunger, if I am worried about my next meal, if my children are starving to death, will I have the incentive of opening the Quran? I shall be consumed with the thought of my next meal. Islam addresses the needs of people. It takes a human from animality and takes them to the realms of angelic beings and beyond, step by step. When will a person dying of hunger stand with a content heart in salah? How will I ever pray the Surah Al-Hamd and know my Allah when I know that my children are dying of hunger at home? When I know that there is no protection for them from the heat of the day and the cold of the night and the rain that descends upon their heads? When will I pray with a content heart? The first need is the physical need. In a narration, Ali ibn Abi Talib salamullah alayhi, in his term of khilafa, of course he was the imam, but in his term of apparent khilafa, he was sitting and mending a patch on his slipper. Ibn Abbas passed, and Abbas had seen how lavishly Osman had lived during his reign of khilafa, and Talha and Zubair, how much possession they had and how much money was given in inheritance after their deaths. He saw the mending a torn slipper and said to the Imam, O Ali, You are a khalif. You are a khalifa. And you are mending a slipper of yours? And Imam Ali looked at Ibn Abbas and said, Oh Ibn Abbas, if I cannot rid the Muslim Ummah of poverty and cause justice to prevail, then this khilafah means less to me than my torn slipper. First and foremost comes the fulfillment of the physical need. After a person has been given his meal, has got a secure income, has got a roof over his head, then talk to them intellectually. Then will their minds open. And once they are trained intellectually, then they will ascend spiritually to meet with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Although the Prophet brought this grand, grand message, the immediate concern of the society of Makkah was their physical needs to redress this social, economical imbalance that was there. Now with every revolution, with every reformer, with every message, you find scholars coming 50, 60, 100 years after the initial reformer and philosophizing upon the message and trying to extract the inner meanings and the implications of the message given by the philosopher or the reformer, don't you? This is why it was necessary for the imams to be there one by one. It was not a waste of time. The great heritage that has been left to us was done by these imams. The first imam comes. He explains through his sermons, through his conduct. But he was allowed only 4 or 5 years. We want to talk about his leadership at a later date in the context of the way he caused progress within the community. His reign or his era was consumed by civil wars. Aisha fought him. Muawiyah fought him. The Kharijis troubled him. The Qasitin, the Mariqin and the Naqisin, as we read from his khutbah of Shakshakiyah. Imam Hassan, he came, contributed in way of supplications, prayers, and the guidance that he was offering his immediate group and followers. Again, the oppressive Bani Umayyah regime suppressed the Imam. Then came Imam Hussein. Again he contributed through his words, through his prayers, through his supplications, through the orders that he left. Imam Hussein was faced by this grand challenge. He went. Imam Sajjad came, Salamullah Ali. And he contributed in terms of spirituality, the greatest treasure that we have, molding and shaping the mind of a Muslim and the heart of a Muslim. The supplications that we have of Sahifa Sajjadiya, they are a grand, grand khazana of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that are with us. Then, Imam Sajjad founded a madrasa in Medina to educate the people. The madrasa was continued by the 5th and the 6th Imam. Now at the time of 5th and 6th Imam, they had breathing space. Bani Umayyah and Bani Abbas were caught between each other. What happened here was that Sadiqain, the two Imams, they gave structure and framework to the Shia thought, the thought of Imamiyya. They gave Shia their legal system. If you look at Furu' al-Kafi, the fiqh that we have, it is all derived from the 5th and the 6th Imam. If you look at the narrations of the 6th Imam, he reports them either through the chain of his fathers from the Prophet or through other chains to the Prophet. All these precepts of jurisprudence that we have and the laws of fiqh that we have are from the 5th Imam and the 6th Imam. They weren't sitting idle. They were working away. They were contributing all the time. They were giving us our theological understanding. At that time, we saw the emergence of theological schools. There were the Ash'arites who were saying that Allah has the sole authority in the sense that we are compelled in our actions. The Mu'tazilites, on the other hand, were saying that we are free agents. With such theological challenges, the 5th and the 6th Imam dealt with them and they said, no, Allah is all authoritative, and yet we are responsible for our actions. And the middle part is the part to pursue. After that, the Bani Abbas came into power, and they allowed every form of theological school to come into the folds of the Muslim world and to propagate their false heretical beliefs. This was the grand challenge faced by the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th and the 11th Imam. They were facing this challenge. The deviant groups of the Shias were challenged by them. The Murji'as, the Sanawiya, the other philosophers that were coming out, the theologians, the deviated systems that were coming, the Imams were challenging them all and shaping the minds of the Shia. If you look at the dua of the 8th Imam, in which he says, Ya man la yukayyif bi kayf wa la yu'ayyan bi ayn. He talks about Allah and gives this unique concept of Allah. O you who cannot be specified by any awareness, or no state may come upon you. Ya mukayyif al kayf wa mu'ayyan al ayn. Then he says, O you who gives howness its how and awareness its where, to shape the minds of the Muslims in the positive sense, in the positive direction. The 7th Imam, look at his contributions, the letters that he has written, the instructions that he has given to his Shias, the supplications that he has offered. At every level they were educating the minds of the Muslims. One incident, when in the court of Bani Abbas there was a problem, a controversy between, or a dispute between two females, both claiming that they were the mother of the male child and denying that the female child was theirs. So you have two women and two babies, one male, one female. Both of these are saying that the male child is my child. The Khalifa of the time summoned the ulama and he said, resolve this problem. They could not. They could not come up with a satisfactory answer from the Quran. And one of the wazirs, he said, well, why don't you ask the son of the Prophet that you have imprisoned in your dungeon to offer the answer, and from the Quran. This is something amazing. Amazing. We are baffled to this day. They went to the Imam. They said, Ibn Rasulullah, we have this problem. Who is the mother of the male child? And who is the mother of the female child? What did he say? Allahu Akbar. He said, extract the milk of both the females. Then weigh the milk. And the one with the greater weight in milk, or greater density and mass in milk, is the mother of the male child. And the one with the lighter milk is the mother of the female child. Ibn Rasulullah. But we ask from the Quran. And he recited the verse, لِلْزَكَرِي مِثْلُ حَزْدِ الْأُنْسَيَيْنِ. The male child will inherit twice as much as the female child. I ask the Imam here one thing. O Imam, as far as the law of inheritance is concerned, that is what is known as conventional law. As far as the weight of milk is concerned, that's a natural phenomena. And look at the beauty of the answer that comes. That the whole of the legal system and the conventional law of Islam is based on natural rights. Allahu Akbar. Look at the beauty, if we can only understand. Look, a man and a woman are physically different, aren't they? They are psychologically different, aren't they? We are so different, we don't think alike. We don't react to situations alike. And hence, whatever we have been enabled naturally, in accordance with that, we have our rights. You will not keep a horse inside the desert, nor will you bring a camel inside the city. Both are different. Both are there to perform equally different roles. And both have different rights in accordance with the natural abilities. But the Arab of that day could not understand what the 7th Imam was saying. In philosophy, there's a massive problem. Do we have natural rights? The whole system of rights that is in a state of confusion right now, it's on this basis that do we have natural rights at all? But in Islam, we are different. everyone's right is different, and we will elaborate on this issue in the coming talks. The 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th Imam, they all go their way, shaping the mind of their Shias, safeguarding this beautiful message of the Blessed Prophet. At the 11th Imam, the 12th Imam goes into occultation. Why? Now, the total message has been given by the 11th Imam. And now is the moment of awaiting an intibar, so that these minds may comprehend the message in its entirety, may be able to appreciate the message. Look at the first 11 Imams. These were grand professors. And who were they given? Little children of elementary classes who could not understand what they were saying. The 12th Imam cannot come. Why? Even if he does come, we will not be able to understand what he is. Because we have not matured. We have not comprehended the message. The message has been given to us. It's intact. It's in its beautiful form. Now, these years that we are being given, the years of intivar, and we want to continue this tomorrow, is the era for us to mature, to understand what this message is all about. We have a hadith that when the 12th Imam comes, he will not come with a stick to make you pray or fast or do Hajj. You will already be fasting, praying and doing Hajj. By understanding the significance of all this, he will only come to put his blessed hand on your heads and to drive your intellect to its perfection. So this period of intivar is for that maturity of the human mind, so that the human mind may evaluate and understand this grand message that they have left. I have heard of a book known as The End of History. He does not mean that the progress of time or the change in the mode of society or economy will come to an end. History is an expression of the mode, change of the modes of society. What the author meant by the end of history was that the human mind at this moment has arrived at a position where nothing can baffle it anymore. If the human mind were to find out that there is other creatures in the heavens, it will not be surprised anymore. If the human mind were to discover that we are not us, we are something else, it would accept it. The human mind, through the progress, has matured to an extent where nothing can surprise it anymore. Have a look. Whereas before, the whole belief of the human being was based upon the fact that earth was the center of universe, and from there we derived the supremacy of mankind. And as soon as it was known that earth is like any other celestial object that is revolving around itself and around everything else, the whole basis of the supremacy of human being collapsed. It was like Qiyamah, this knowledge. Basing our belief on false notions is this. The human mind can accept now that whatever I know may be right, but there may be a greater truth beyond it. The human mind has this tendency that we want to compartmentalize things, we want to categorize things in order to understand them. So we formulate a law, a universal law, and then if anything is against it, we say this is an exception. That was before. Now the human mind says that because this is not following the law, it means there must be another law governing the whole thing, as opposed to calling it an exception to the rule. Yes? Whereas before, the meteorological department used to say that the whole process of the weather change is haphazard and at random, it has no system. Now it is saying, even in randomness there is a system there in operation. Same with the Shia mind. And I have to conclude. Same with the Shia mind. We must not base our Islam on false notions, so that when these notions are broken, that our Islam is broken altogether. We must have that sort of an open mind to be able to accept the truth and to understand the truth. It is not necessary that what our ulama understood 1,000 years ago was the truth. Yes, it was the truth for them in accordance with their understanding. Islam does not shy away. It is for every era, every generation. It is for mankind till the end of day, till the day of Qiyamah. Have a look. Before the time of, a very mundane example, before the time of Allama Hilli, it used to be popularly acknowledged that well water became najis upon contact of najasa. Allama Hilli came, reviewed the ahadith, and he concluded, no, that well water is like flowing water. He broke a tradition of 700 years. And today every alim is saying it is like flowing water. It is a very mundane example. A very mundane example. This applies in case of our theology, our philosophy, our understanding of imamat. If at times we find, if somebody says that Imam Ali cooperated with Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, we find it unbelievable. Why can't we think this way? That if Imam Ali cooperated with them, there must be a greater truth in there. Imam Ali married the widow of Abu Bakr. It does not mean that wrong becomes right and right becomes wrong. But it means that there is something to discover from there. There is something to understand. We need that sort of a mind. A mind totally sincere for the cause of Islam. We shall continue it tomorrow. But we want to end with a narration of the love of our hearts, the light of our eyes. A mystic, in his mystical thoughts, explains the Shahada of Hussein ibn Ali. He says that as Hussein fell from his horse, and then saw this,